Thank you so much. Great to be on the phone with all of you tonight. Thank you so much for dialing in. Greg said it before, and I'll just repeat it. This is truly no substitute for when we get a chance to meet in person. It's the best I can do tonight because we've been working late every night down here in Olympia in the State House to do the work we've got to do in 105 days. So I can't make it back up there as often as I'd like. But I want to thank those of you who were able to come to our live town hall in person at Redmond City Hall last month. It was great. We had a fantastic turnout. I've been told it's one of the biggest we've had ever, and we got a chance to talk about a whole host of issues. And I know we'll have a chance to do some of that again tonight. When we finish the session, I'll be back up practicing law and back home, living up in my home in Kirkland, and we'll be setting up regular coffee hours and chances for anyone to come and meet me and sit down. I want to be as accessible to you as possible. So if you have something you'd like to talk to me about one-on-one or in private, we will have plenty of opportunities to do that over the summer and into the fall and winter. We've been working very hard here. We're in day number 95 of a 105-day legislative session this year. Our big challenges this year are to pass a balanced budget, to fully fund education after the Supreme Court's ruling last year that made it clear that we are not doing that, so to significantly improve our funding of education while balancing the budget, to make a decision on whether or not to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. And in my book, we have some other opportunities as well, and we're taking advantage of those with varying degrees of success. One of those is to make an investment in our transportation infrastructure, and I'll tell you more about that later on. Also to, in the wake of the Newton, Connecticut massacre in December, trying to do some substantive work around mental health as well as some very basic common sense firearm safety work. So those are some of the opportunities and challenges we've got here. I think we're doing a good job in that we have both the Senate and the House have passed balanced budget proposals. They look very different from one another. And so now begins the, you know, the horse trading and the bargaining and the negotiating to try to get to something that both the House and the Senate can agree on and that the governor can agree on, because ultimately we need his signature on that document. So that's a $34.5 billion project, and so we're going to be working hard, and while I hope that we can finish on time, you know, sometimes these budget negotiations can go long, and so we're concerned that we may end up going a little bit past the end of the session for budget negotiations. But the most important thing is that we pass a balanced budget, which is a fiscally responsible thing to do that meets our education and social service and economic development needs. The House budget proposal, which I've voted for last week, put over a $1.3 billion into education. We think that's the right thing to do because K-12 education is where you get your best bang for the buck. It also put $32 million more in mental health, for example, so that we can make sure that we treat people before we have some devastating consequences. It does a whole host of other things, and I'll go into more details as we get questions, but I just wanted to give you kind of the big picture of where we're at. Tomorrow in the Transportation Committee, on which I serve, we will hear a revenue package proposal put together by Judy Cliburn, the chair of that committee, and I will be looking very closely at that. Before I vote to raise the gas tax, I want to make sure that I will only do that if it's the right thing for my district. And I've been pretty tough on this, that we've got to make sure that 520 and other projects that are important to us are funded. Otherwise, I'm not going to vote to up that gas tax. So there's kind of the big picture. For me personally, I've been working hard on economic development. I'm the vice chair of the Technology and Economic Development Committee. And I have a proposal which was included in the governor's budget proposal, which gives tax-free status to our high-tech startups for their first 3 years. We are the only state in the country that taxes startups with a B&O tax before they're even profitable. I think that's wrong. It's the wrong thing to do to incentivize entrepreneurship. And so I am pushing hard to make sure that we can get tax-free status for our startups so that we can get more Microsofts and Amazons in our region. That's the big picture and my particular interest. And now, Greg, if we want to If you want to start off with a question, or we can open it up to questions on the phone lines, I'm open to whatever we do next.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very much, Representative. And remember, listeners, to press *3 on your telephone keypad if you wish to ask a question directly of Representative Habib. And if you do that, you will be connected to a volunteer who will take your question and get you into the queue to speak directly with the representative. So remember, that's *3 on your telephone keypad, and you can go live with Representative Habib and ask him a question. We have a question now from Jennifer. Jennifer has a question. It's a little different than most of our questions, but it's about homeschooling. So, Jennifer, please go ahead with your question.
Hi there.
I was wondering what you're doing to support homeschooling families in your district.
Sure. Well, one of the things I think we need to do, I'm glad you asked, that's, of course, an option that some families take, and we respect that, and I'm supportive of that. So one of the things that I think we can do best for our homeschool families is make sure that we have the services for their kids to participate in some of the services they might get in schools that they nevertheless have access to those. So, for example, and those run the gamut, we have an economically diverse district, so there's places in our, in our district where there's great economic need and basic human services needs, and so whether it's making sure that there is basic food access, shelter, affordable housing, those basic needs that kids need in order to learn, that we have those, as well as supplemental, for example, I'm working on an initiative right now to get college readiness access for students throughout the state. Those are the kind of services I want to make sure are available to people, whether they're homeschooled or in our traditional schools. The other thing is they're, making sure that, so for example, we are also fighting for funding in our capital budget for sports and athletic fields that are publicly available for young people to use. Because, if you're homeschooled, you may not have access to, depending on the arrangement of the school district, you may not have access to athletics, and I think it's very important that kids have that social outlet. Just because they're homeschooled and the parents have made that academic choice doesn't mean that that their child should not, be exposed to social opportunities, which we know are so important. Finally, we are doing a lot of innovative work in this state around digital learning, and trying to. We have an initiative around that we are funding to make sure that we have digital learning curriculum available, and so I'm going to look into making sure that that's also accessible to homeschool parents, because that could be a great resource to them.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Habib. And remember, listeners, just press *3 on your telephone keypad, and you will be connected with a volunteer who will take your question and get you into the queue to speak directly with Representative Habib. And now we have a question about transportation, and it's from Bob in Bellevue. Bob, go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, Congressman. My question is on the transportation budget. We seem to come up with grandiose plans which cost billions of dollars, and an example is the interchange at 167 and 405 and the proposed 167 I-5 at 5, which build multi-tier on and off ramps, sometimes with 8, 10, 12 off or overpasses, which cost roughly $1 billion each, which then box the interchange in so that it can never be expanded without tearing it down.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be prevalent in all of our building, that we don't ever look to the future. And when we're doing something like put in a sign bridge or anything, make it wide enough so that you can add another lane without tearing the sign bridge down.
Right. So I think that is you're absolutely right that making sure that as we build transportation infrastructure, we are looking forwards is critical, both in terms of as you're pointing out, the kind of the flexibility of the systems you're building, but also that we're thinking really intelligently about the capacity that we want to have. Now, on the 167-405 corridor, that's an important corridor for freight mobility. It's important for Boeing. It's important for our port system. And so, you know, that's one where, you know, for example, to that's a corridor that combined with when it, where it meets I-90, that corridor from a north-south and an east-west perspective allows us to move freight to and from our ports very effectively. So with that, you know, I think one of the really great innovative ideas that we have is the idea of express tolling. It doesn't work all the time, but there's instances where, you know, you can very intelligently give people the option to buy into faster capacity. And so, you know, the business community is telling us that's what we want to see. We want to be able to, you know, pay a dollar and be able to get into an express lane. Commuters sometimes are saying that, and that just gives us some flexibility to price the capacity. Now, in terms of the interchange design, you know, we just passed in the House a handful of transportation reform bills today. We do need to do everything we can to make sure that the engineering around those, and I'm not an engineer, and you sound like you've got more expertise certainly than I do around how those are designed, but I can tell you that when it comes to, for example, 520 and some of the design decisions that have been made, not all of those, I'm not a huge fan of all of those, but I do think that we're on the right path to make sure that that's something that will be a bridge that will work for us for another 75 years. So we do think about that. One other area where we think about, you know, kind of in a progressive, forward-looking way is on how are we incorporating light rail and transit, you know, mass rapid transit solutions so that, you know, people are, we know that in 50 or 75 years, there's going to be so many people that, you know, we can't build enough freeway lanes to accommodate them. We just can't. And so we do need to keep growing our freeways, but we also need to be looking at a multimodal transportation system. That's a bipartisan view. And so I think with I-90 and bringing light rail across I-90 into Bellevue up to Redmond, I think that's going to be a very important long-term infrastructural decision. And to your point, Bob, we are looking very carefully, actually, at where those, you know, where that alignment is, as you know, in Bellevue, where you live, where that alignment goes so that we're not creating a hassle for ourselves that we got to fix down the line. So, and if you, you know, you sound like you're an expert in that, so be in touch with us because you might recognize engineering issues that I might not, and so I'm happy to bring that perspective to the committee or even invite you down to testify.
All right. Thank you very much, Bob and Representative Habib. Remember, listeners, if you would like to speak directly to the representative, press *3 on your telephone keypad, and you'll be connected to it with a volunteer who can get your question into the queue. Our next question is from Jim, and he has a question about tax benefits and credits for high-tech startups. Jim, you want to go ahead, please?
My favorite type of question.
Hey, thanks a lot for hosting this program. And
thanks, Jim.
So as a practicing CPA firm on the east side, I heard you talk about a proposal for some sort of tax credit or tax benefit for high-tech startups. Can you sort of explain how you imagine that might work?
Absolutely. So this is a bill. So I work with startups, every day in my day job. And what I recognized was that, most states, over 40 states, have a corporate income tax, meaning a tax. And Jim, you already know this, but I'm going to just say this for the benefit of other people on the line. Corporate income tax, which taxes your net profit, not your gross revenue. So, you know, when you're filling out your business taxes, smart people like Jim are able to help you itemize your costs and deduct your costs, and so you're only paying on your net profit. We are one of a handful of states, we're actually one of only three states in the country, believe it or not, that actually tax you as a business on your revenue. It's a low tax. It's anywhere from 0.4% to 1.8%, but it's on your gross receipts. And so if you imagine you have a low margin business where, the example I always give is auto dealers, you know, they're making a lot of revenue because, you know, they're selling cars. But guess what? Their costs are also high because they're also buying a lot of cars. So, you know, their margins are low. And So it hits those kind of companies really, really hard. It also hits startups very hard because oftentimes they're not even profitable yet, even when they're making revenue, because they're still investing in research and development. They've got lots of costs associated with their, you know, with their investors, upfront startup costs. So what my bill does is it says, look, we used to be, frankly, in the, right here in the 48th, we used to be second only to Silicon Valley. I mean, basically, if you wanted to start a tech startup, you either went to Palo Alto in San Francisco area, or you came here, because this is where the, you had the, you know, all the smart people, great companies like Microsoft and later Amazon, Boeing, lots of talent, you know, great quality of life here, great schools for the kids. So, you know, if you come here now, we've got a situation where Austin, Texas, North Carolina, Virginia, Boston, Massachusetts, even Indianapolis, these places are actually beating us out in a lot of areas when it comes to startup activity. New York, you know, Mayor Bloomberg initiated something called Silicon Alley, and now they've got a huge startup ecosystem, and Cornell University is building a research university campus there in New York. So we've got a lot of challenges that we didn't used to have, and we're slipping. And we're slipping farther and farther behind in terms of startups. And so to solve that, it's going to take a number of solutions. One thing we got to do is we've got to invest more in our higher ed system. You know, we don't have nearly enough slots for all the people who want to study computer science at the University of Washington. We need to expand that. We need to grow our computer science programs at Western. We need to do more even at Bellevue College, which, you know, can have the capacity to deliver a lot of that education. So we need to do that. But we also can look at our tax policy, and the fact that we have the worst tax policy for startups, to me, sends absolutely the wrong message. And so what happens a lot of times, businesses will start up, and then as soon as they start looking like they're going to go somewhere and they're going to start bringing in revenue, they move down to California. We got to stop that. So what my bill does is it says for your first 3 years, if you're a Washington-based company and you're in your first 3 years and you have four employees or more, because we don't want it to be a shell company, and you've got to actually be hiring people, your first $1 million in gross receipts are tax-free. Now, we're going to, you know, this is getting some traction now, and I can't promise that, you know, if it passes at the very end, it'll still be a million. I'm going to keep pushing for that, but we are going to make sure that your first significant amount of revenue is going to be tax-free, so you get a chance to get off the ground. I think that's the right thing to do to grow the economy, and guess what? That's money that's going to be able to help us pay for even more education for our kids and even more investments in higher ed 20 years from now, and that's the right thing to do.
All right. Thank you very much, caller, and thank you very much, Representative Habib. Remember, listeners, if you want to ask a question of Representative Habib, like that last one, just press *3 on your telephone keypad, and you can get into the queue. Our next question has to do with the school budget and performance grades for schools. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, Representative Habib. This is Anthony from Redmond. I first want to say thank you for this forum. I'm very impressed with the way this is transpiring.
Thanks so much, Anthony. Thanks for calling in.
Sure. Now, I am an education researcher, and I've done a lot of work on different standards. The way I understand the performance standards written into the education funding bill for Washington State is to give schools a letter grade. Is that correct?
So we have so what we've done in the past is we've graded schools, you know, on a kind of you know, excellent, good, fair, poor standard. There's a proposal this year, and we passed different versions of it in the Senate and the House. But what we want to do, and the governor believes is right, and both the House and the Senate think is the right thing to do, is in some ways actually, you know, tighten that up a little bit and give it, you know, give it grades
okay,
the same way we give our students grades. And so the plan, though, is to do that in such a way where we don't, you know, we don't do kind of the, you know, what I, you know, No Child Left Behind model, if you will, where, you know, we actually defund the bad schools. I think the plan here is actually to say, let's get some data about what's working and what schools are not working, and then let's focus our efforts on improving the ones that are not working. And so this is an attempt to do that.
Okay. Our findings at our research laboratory are such that when demarcations such as an A, B, C, D, or E, F grade are just listed, even if it's numerical grade or even something as anecdotal as excellent, fair, poor, etc., can be easily misused because they become arbitrary lines in the sand that focus more on measurement rather than development. So the indicators for each of those levels need to be expressed in such a way that any deficiencies or gaps are highlighted, and so that objectives or the goal setting for schools to get to the next level in the hierarchy are clearly articulated as indicators of success. That helps make the standards more focused on measure on development rather than just measurement. Does that make sense?
I think that's right, and I think, you know, that's kind of the difference between how the House and the governor view things as compared to how the Senate does. I think, you know, we called for, and you're probably aware of this, that there was a back and forth with the governor's office on this issue. And I think that what we're calling for is usable information. I mean, you know, I always say, okay, so if you're in, if you live like in Rainier Beach, you know, and your local school gets gets an F, I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, you're going to move? You know, areas that have economic difficulty often have schools that are underfunded, often require more social services and wraparound service that their kids aren't getting. But it's not like an open marketplace where you can pick up and move to Mercer Island or pick up and move to Medina. You can't necessarily do that. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, some property values are higher, and so people live in certain places. Now, that's why I think you're absolutely right. What is usable information is, you know, because actually that would just be, I mean, how terrible would it be if you find out, okay, now my school's failing, but there's nothing I can do about it. So what's actually usable, though, is if we could say, here's where your school is, and we recognize maybe there's class size issues. Maybe there's leadership issues with the, you know, in terms of the principal and the administration. Maybe there's school supplies issues. Maybe attendance is down because there's transportation issues. Maybe there's a high level of free and reduced lunch, students of free and reduced lunch, but when they go home, they're not getting the food or basic needs that they have. So we have to connect them with those resources in a better way in terms of wraparound services. That's what we need. Otherwise, I think you're absolutely right. It's completely pointless just to give a letter grade and then walk away as if we've done our job. That's just the starting point. And I hope that that's where, when this is said and done this year in terms of this debate around grading schools, I hope that's where we land, because I think that's a much smarter position.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Habib and Anthony. And remember, press *3 on your telephone keypad if you would like to ask a question of Representative Habib. Our next questioner is Karen, and she wants to know about closing tax loopholes. Karen, please go ahead with your question.
Hi, Mr. Habib. Thank you again for hosting this forum in this format. I live in Bellevue, and I have a child that goes to Issaquah School District, where more than 20% of the operating budget is funded by school levies. And, of course, the McCleary decision has put K-12 education in the forefront of everybody's minds. And when local levies are funding so much of what our schools have to do, I'm wondering, why can't we generate the revenue somewhere else so that school districts, like the one that you just mentioned in Clover Park, I think it was, why can't they get the same services? Well, I have to believe that it's because people are using tax loopholes, and we've got to generate more revenue. So I'm curious as to what you're doing to close revenue, to close loopholes, generate more revenue, so that we can fund all these services that you're talking about in future budgets.
Absolutely, and thank you, Karen. Thanks so much for the question. And I think that is probably the single biggest question down here in Olympia this year. And you've really hit the nail on the head. We do, you know, this is one of the things that I think gets lost sometimes that you focused on very, very accurately, which is, you know, what the McCleary decision is saying is not just that our schools are underfunded, but it's very specific in saying it's the state's obligation You know, it's the state that has the obligation. It's in our state constitution. The paramount duty is to make ample provision for a basic education. So it's, you know, there are areas in the state where through local levies, the taxpayers are making up some of that difference, and, you know, in various degrees. And we're actually very lucky, for example, in Bellevue to have very, you know, first of all, to have the property tax base, to have, private dollars that supplement, to have PTAs, et cetera. But that's, as you point out, it's not something that other parts of the state can benefit from, even our neighbors in Seattle or down in Renton. And so what we need to do is, this is not a local obligation, this is a state obligation. So we are going to, that's why we are, and under our plan, we're going to put $1.3 billion more into basic education, into K-12 education. Now, some of that we're doing through a series of closing tax loopholes. Now, I want to make it clear, you know, the B&O tax, which I described earlier, is a defective tax. It's just not a great tax because, as I pointed out earlier, it hits some companies harder than others. It doesn't recognize that some businesses have, you know, bigger cost drivers than others. It doesn't recognize, it doesn't allow us to incentivize economic development. And we have fewer tools to do economic development than other states. You know, some states actually just write a big check and say, oh, we want, you know, X company to come here to Austin. We're going to, you know, buy you a big, you know, office park or, you know, so we can't do that. And I'm not sure we'd ever want to do that. And so we have fewer tools. One of the tools we have is we say, okay, we recognize the B&O is a pretty harsh tax. We can. We want to help the aerospace industry, so we're going to actually help by giving you a preferential rate to stimulate that. So they're not always bad, right? Tax preferences are not always bad. But what's bad about the way we treat them in the state is we don't revisit them. We kind of we pass them, and then, you know, 60, 70 years later, in some cases, they're still there. And then it becomes so politically impossible to close one of them, because as soon as you do, you know, they've got, you know, a whole army of lobbyists, and they'll come down and they'll try to, you know, make your life difficult, and they'll, so it's not to say that all tax preferences, I support, for example, as, you know, as was said earlier, I'm actually introducing a tax preference. So, you know, some people think I'm swimming upstream, but I think this is a good tax preference for startup businesses. Now, that's one where you're tailoring it to companies and entrepreneurs who really need it. There's some that I'm not sure. I'm not sure, for example, if, you know, having a tax exemption for Miller and Coors and Anheuser-Busch, all out-of-state companies, all companies that are doing very well, you know, is necessary. So that's one of the things I'm going to be looking at before I vote on it. Now, I'll tell you, like, for example, with that one, I make a strong distinction between those companies I just mentioned and, like, you know, Mac and Jack or Black Raven or other, you know, craft breweries that we have right here, because we do want to help our startup breweries. I'm very proud of the work we're doing with microbrews and micro distilleries right here, even on the east side. So again, each of these things you got to think through, but we are taking a hard look at out-of-date tax preferences that no longer serve a purpose, that do not give a good ROI, good return on investment for the taxpayer, because it's your money. You know, I mean, if we give a tax break to Anheuser-Busch, then it's you and all the people on the call who are going to have to pay more in property taxes and in their sales taxes and in school levies, you know, make up the difference. And I just don't think that's right. I think everyone ought to have either taxes revisited and looked at. We got to have the best, fairest tax system for everybody to fund our schools. So thank you, Karen, for that question.
Yes, thank you, Karen, and thank you, Representative Habib. Remember, press *3 on your phone if you'd like to ask a question of Representative Habib. And actually, that's a good segue into our next question from Priscilla in Kirkland, who has a question about property taxes, I believe property tax exemption levels. Priscilla, please go ahead with your question.
Well, thank you, and this is an honor and a pleasure and perfect timing. I came in the door just as the phone was ringing, so perfect timing.
Perfect.
Thank you for this. Thank you so much. Pardon me. Yes, we get Social Security, and according to King County Treasury, if you make any more than $35,000, you do not get the senior discount. And when I turn 72, and likewise with my husband, then you start getting your paybacks from your annuities and stuff. So that put us over the $35,000. So when I did fill out that form to send it back in to King County Treasurer, of course, I got the notice that we're no longer can apply for senior discount. So on the back of our invoice, I called all the numbers I could to see what help I could get. And somewhere along the line, forgive me for not remembering, but someone said that they were trying to get it up to $40,000 for senior citizens to get a senior citizen discount on property taxes. Have you heard about that?
This has been an issue we've been looking at, and I will get back to you specifically on where we are on it. I can tell you that the approach that I've advocated, and I've spoken with our assessor, Lloyd Hara, about this, is that, you know, one of the areas where we actually, I think, somewhat are disadvantaged is, you know, King County is a higher cost of living than other counties. And so, you know, I actually think that when we do these kinds of policies, we need to reflect the fact, and it should really be tied to median income in the county that you live in. And so, you know, like if you're living in Kirkland, King County should be different than other parts of the state. Now, that's a very, you know, as you know, those kind of things are controversial, because you've got representatives from all over the state. But, you know, I think this is one where I absolutely think that that has not changed. That number, 35,000 that you just quoted, has not changed since, I think, 97, if I'm not mistaken. So it's been, you know, it's been a long, long time. And I do absolutely think we need to take a look at that and up that, and I'd like to do it in a structural way where it's tied to county median income or some other indicator that is fair to the people who live in King County. Thank you for that question.
All right. Thank you very much, questioner. Our next question comes from Margaret in Redmond, and she wants to know about the background checks for firearms proposal. Margaret, please go ahead with your question.
Thank you, and thank you for hosting this forum. I think it's very, very helpful.
Thanks, Margaret.
You're welcome. I'm wondering what Washington State House and Senate, how they will respond to the massacres that we've had. The federal Congress has decided not to take action, and I know that some states are taking action. And the least harmful from a NRA standpoint seems to be the background checks, and I just wondered where this might be going in Washington State.
I got to tell you, this probably the most disappointing evening so far this session for me was the night that we were unable to pass the background check bill that you described. I am a fervent believer that this is a common sense solution. It is for gun owners. It is absolutely not going to change their lives one bit. It is totally respectful of the Second Amendment. I am respectful of the Second Amendment and Washington State's own constitution and the constitutional right to bear arms. So there's no question there. But the reality is 40% of firearm purchases do not happen at licensed gun stores. So, you know, nearly half of the guns that are being bought without any background check. And so what that means is, you know, you could be a felon. You could be a released felon, and we wouldn't know it. And with the weapons that we have out there now, one of these, you know, AR-15 assault weapons, I mean, so – again, some of the people who are in opposition say, well, that's not going to, you know, criminals don't abide by the law, you know, and that's true. But we don't eliminate, you know, we don't eliminate every single law that people don't abide by. We don't, that's not a reason not to have the law. That's a reason to have better enforcement. So, and for example, we're just now, by the way, we're working on drunk driving legislation. I'll get into that hopefully before the end of the hour. If not, I'll mention it in my closing remarks. But, you know, tougher enforcement is what we need. We don't just say, well, we're not up to this challenge. This state is up to the challenge to say, you know, let people buy whatever guns are legal for them to buy, but let's just make sure that we're not putting them in the hands of felons or people who have been deemed mentally unstable or have been committed to a mental institution. I mean, that is what we're talking about, is people getting out of a mental hospital who have been deemed incompetent by courts, and yet they go out and right now they can go to one of these out-of-state gun shows like at Puyallup or wherever, and they can buy these things, and all we're saying is you should be subject to the same background checks that the private gun store, that the licensed gun stores have to do. Now, today, it was very disappointing. Even more disappointing than that, frankly, was today the Senate did not pass even a bipartisan piece of legislation that the NRA supports, which we passed out on a huge bipartisan vote over here in the House, which says if you are on a domestic violence protection order, the courts granted a protection order for domestic violence, you should not be able to carry a gun on a domestic violence protection order. And I was disappointed that Senator Tom, my seatmate here, and the state Senate did not bring that up for a vote. He's the majority leader right now, which is why I mention him. I don't know his position on the issue, but he's the majority leader in the Senate. They did not bring that to a vote in the Senate, along with, by the way, a bunch of other things related to reproductive health and women's right to choose and other issues. They didn't do that, and that was disappointing because I think we can all agree. I mean, you could be the most ardent NRA supporter, and I think we all agree that if you've got a domestic violence protection order, you should not be able to have a gun with which to threaten your wife and kids or your, you know, whatever it is, whoever you've got the order against. So to answer your question, it is a huge source of disappointment this year. I hope that we can do something either next year or by ballot initiative. And, Margaret, please stay engaged on that issue. It's we need to hear your voice. You need to speak up. I don't know whether you speak up as just a citizen or as a mother or, you know, but with any capacity, please be active on this, because we really, really need to do some basic common sense things that are still constitutional, because we've all seen that that's also not happening in D.C., which is also disappointing. Thank you for your question.
Thank you very much for your answer, Representative Beebe, and for your question. And actually, that does segue pretty nicely into our next question, which is about DUI, with a bit of a twist, I think, from Lauren. Lauren, go ahead with your question, please.
Oh, yes. Thank you again for the forum. Yes, my question is on DUI. And it's about the issue, you know, there's a lot of proposals now, of course, being put out because of the recent tragic accidents. And I've heard about, for instance, you know, stiffening up the breathalyzers that allow you to start your car. That's a good one. More extreme, of course, is taking vehicles away, which I think is something that should be discussed, but that's extreme. And the issues around licenses and vehicles, you know, get at actually driving. And one of the problems is driving is a necessity for many people, particularly in rural areas. But there's one area that I feel like has been a blind spot. And I saw recently in the paper there's a couple people that did propose it. And that is the fact that, for instance, we restrict the sale of alcohol to minors. And we check identification for that. But we have no restriction whatsoever in restricting the sale of alcohol to people who have been convicted of multiple DUIs. Mm-hmm. And the irony is that until recently, a person could come out having recently been convicted of a DUI, walk into a liquor store in the state of Washington, sells them the liquor. And right. I noticed that one of the people that was recently charged in one of the tragic accidents, a judge had recently forbidden him from drinking alcohol. Yet, right. There was no forbidding him from buying it, and of course we know how well that works. You know, right. He's forbidden. He can go buy all of it that he wants to, but he's not supposed to drink it.
Right.
You know, that is
right.
Fairly.
So that's so.
So I wonder what your support is for this idea in instituting. Of course, it means everyone gets checked on
yeah.
their identification. But.
So thank you for that, and that is, you know, I'm actually a co-sponsor. I was a co-sponsor of the original bill, and then there's now a new bill that Representative Morrell and others have been working hard on with the governor. And it's been a bipartisan effort on both sides of the legislature. We recognize the importance of this. The bill now that we have before us, which is kind of what you might think of as an omnibus DUI bill, will be the single biggest step on this issue in years and years and years. It does some combination of all of the things that you just described. It first of all, mandates an interlock device after your second conviction. And I want to say something, by the way, because it sounds like when you say, well, your second time, maybe you think that's your second time driving drunk. They estimate that for every time an individual is pulled over for drunk driving, not arrested, not convicted, but just pulled over, for every single time, they have actually driven drunk 85 times. So it's one in 85 times that you even get pulled over. Then, after you get pulled over, then you got to assume, well, not all those people get arrested. Get charged. Not all that get charged actually get convicted. Many of them will, the first time, will actually get a reduced sentence to like reckless driving or a negligent driving, or under current law they'll get a deferred sentence. And so those are all, so then you think, okay, well, then by the time you get to your second DUI conviction, you've probably driven drunk hundreds and hundreds of times. And that's the reality for some of these people. So it's not actually unduly harsh to say after your second, your second time. Now, what we need to do is we need to make sure that people can drive, to your point. And so I support a system where if we impound the car, okay, so right then you get pulled over, you're drunk driving, we actually impound your car so that, you don't drive on it the next day and go pick up more booze. And then we need to get it back as quickly as possible, but with an interlock device, so that people can actually drive. As you point out, it's an economic issue. People need to get to work. People need to get their kids to school, et cetera. So we do that, but with an interlock device that keeps the rest of us safe on the road. Then, on the issue of licenses, I think you're absolutely right. And this bill does include after your third time, a new license. Now that, what we want to be careful of, and what I need to talk to my constituents who own restaurants and bars is that feasible to ID every single person? I like to joke that, as I go on the legislature, I'm losing my hair so fast that I'm getting carded less and less often. But I'm still relatively young. But, if you get to a point where you're carding, people who are 75 years old for a glass of Chardonnay, we might want to go there, but let's just really be intentional about that. Let's make that decision, because that's different than at a liquor store. Liquor store should be carding everybody. That's their, that's their job. But now, of course, we're selling liquor in grocery stores too. So we just got to think about it. I'm open to that piece of it, but I recognize that it is it's something that's going to take a lot of retraining and work. And so, but we've got to really do everything we can around this. I've been very, very outspoken on the drunk driving issue. And by the way, it's not just drunk driving. It's also, as we legalize marijuana now, people driving when they're stoned and high. And I think the other issue that I came down here before I was even elected, I was outspoken on the issue of distracted driving, and we got a distracted driving law. So we also know that accidents do occur as a result of texting while driving and other things. So I do encourage everyone on the line. I know you're all very active and smart, wonderful people, so it's not you, but just tell all your friends not to do that. Use a Bluetooth device or pull over if you want to make a phone call or send a text or something like that. So those are all things we need to do, because you're absolutely right, Lauren, that we lose more people every year to drunk driving than to violent crime. More, and so we should spend the money on it. I would have actually liked to see us do something that it looks like we don't have the funding to do right now, but I would have pushed for, and I was pushing, frankly, for, instead of it being the fifth time, right now under law, it's not until your fifth conviction that you are convicted of a felony, on your fifth DUI conviction. I think it ought to be your third, and that takes some money I think that's a good use of some of the money from our marijuana revenue that we're going to get, but we're not quite there yet. I'm going to keep pushing for that.
All right. Thank you very much. And here's a question that relates to driving, although not to driving under the influence, and it is from Frank in Bellevue. Frank, go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, Representative Hobby. My wife and I moved here to the east side of the Bellevue area approximately 46 years ago, and since that time we have retired, but we find out that the cost of living here has gone up so greatly it's really difficult. Let me give you an example here. You know, our children went to the University of Washington, and we paid $220 a quarter for tuition, and this was back in the 80s and the early 90s. And now it's my grandkids are paying far, far more than that, up in the, you know, almost $10,000. I guess I have a concern there. But one of my other concerns is the fact that we're trying to put tolls and taxes on everything that we do and every time we turn around. And the latest is trying to put a tax or a toll on I-90. You know, we've already put a toll on 520. If they put a toll on I-90, we can't drive from the east side into Seattle without having to pay. I think that's unreasonable. And my concern is I think needs to be brought to a halt. You know, we've got to stop the increased cost, especially for seniors.
I think you're thank you, Frank, for that that input. And I think, you know, let me just take one of the things that you mentioned. For example, I think higher ed, I'm glad you mentioned it because I'd actually have been upset if we hadn't talked about it. I will tell you, one of the disappointments for me in the budget proposal that we put out, and it's only because of, you know, our need to do K-12 this year in such a significant way, but I do regret that that the cost of higher ed continues to go up. I wish we could have done something more there, both in terms of keeping tuition low and also in terms of funding our state need grant better to get financial aid to more kids. We need to do that. You're absolutely right. My dad is a Husky, and you know, he went to the U many years ago, over four decades ago, and times have certainly changed. We are pricing the middle class out of higher education, and so that is something that I'm not on the higher education committee, but I will continue to work on that because we've got to fix that problem next year. So thank you so much for bringing that to my attention before we're done with the hour. I'm glad I got to talk about higher ed.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Habib, and listeners. That's all the time we have for questions tonight. If we didn't get to your question, please stay on the line, because in just a moment, you'll have the chance to leave a voicemail directly for Representative Habib with your questions, comments, or feedback. And be sure to leave some contact information so that he and his staff can reach out to you as well. Thank you again for joining tonight's conversation. And now Representative Habib has some final thoughts.
Thank you so much, Greg. Thank you very much to the volunteers who have been helping us do this in a kind of logical and logical and easy way, streamlining this process so we can get as many calls as we can. I want to apologize to those who didn't get through tonight with a call. And please listen to what Greg said. If you just stay on the line, you'll be able to leave me a message. And it'll also have my personal cell phone number on there. Please do feel free to give me a call. And I'm going to do my best to call you back as soon as I can. But I get all your messages, and I will be available to meet with you as soon as we get done here and I come back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for letting me play Dave Ross or, you know, your favorite talk show host. It's kind of fun experience for me to sit here and take calls like a radio talk show host. I hope I got to answer the questions adequately. And again, thank you for the honor of being able to serve you. This is my first year, and I've learned just a ton. I'm going to keep learning, keep working hard for all of you every day that I'm down here and when I get back as well. Thank you. I look forward to meeting you back in the district. Good night.